Well, Joe, thanks for coming out, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a lot of people know who you are, and there's a whole bunch of things to talk about. I mean, it's a crazy world we live in, man. I'm surprised that you and your wife Heather are in the fight still in Washington, given all the circumstances of what are going on. We'll talk about that, but let's just start from the origin story, because I want to give people some context and some background of like where you grew up and then your military experience leading up to some of the things we'll talk about.
Yeah, definitely, man. So grew up in Portland, Oregon, just to the south of where I live right now.
When it was great.
Yeah. When it was like a normal, nice little city. So yeah, I always caveat and say the Portland of the 80s and the 90s. So I was really involved in Boy Scouts growing up. As far back as I can remember, I just wanted to be a commando. I mean, it was like combination of A-Team, G.I. Joe, pretty much the story of like every Green Beret. Like, you know, so did that and then figured out, hey, I want to go right into the Army as soon as I possibly can. The Black Hawk Down incident in 93 happened when I was in high school. And I think that was probably like the first Gulf War was kind of on TV a little bit.
Yeah.
But that was just sort of like, hey, look, our missiles can shoot really far. Like 93 Black Hawk Down was like brutal combat up close and personal.
And I remember CNN like showed the bodies being dragged through the streets on TV.
Yeah.
And just blurred out the face.
Yeah. I remember seeing that and being like, wow, these are guys who maybe were in my high school just a couple of years ago.
Wow.
And like now they're over there duking it out. Like whoever those guys are, I want to go do that. And so went and talked to the Army recruiters and they're like, well, you can't go be a Green Beret right away. It doesn't work that way, but you can be a Ranger. And that's who was in the whole Black Hawk Down incident. So I got a Ranger contract right away, went right to 275.
What year was that?
So I joined in 98.
Awesome. Yeah, I was just a year ahead of you in 97.
Yeah.
But I had the option 40 contract where they didn't honor my option 40.
Really?
Well, they made me 11 X-ray.
Yep.
And so they designated me 11 hotel, and there was no 11 hotels in Ranger Battalion, even though I had an option 40 and wound up not going to Ranger Battalion.
Recruiters are super tricky.
That back then, especially.
Yes.
Because it was like, it was all about numbers, right?
Yeah.
So you had a 275 experience. How was that overall for you?
It was awesome, man. Best place, I think, in the military to grow up. Because the military of like the late 90s, I don't think had a real combat focus, but Ranger Regiment, just because of the culture of regiment, but then also because I think they had experienced the most recent brutal combat, they had a combat mentality. And so everything from the time I got there until the time I left was, are you physically fit? Can you shoot your weapon? Do you understand basic tactics? And that was just drilled into me. And I'm really fortunate that I started out there, you know, especially with the way that the war has accelerated later on.
What year did you go to Ranger school?
I went in 99.
I went in 99 too.
Yeah.
What class were you?
I was there for a long time.
Were you? The extended course?
I did the extended course. Yeah, we started in June and then I was there until like December.
Yeah, I was in 500. So I started in winter of 99 and graduated in winter of 2000.
Okay. Yeah, so I was 100, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy world. So you do... Like a lot of people who don't know progressive evolution of operators and special operations, typically if they want to go to be a Green Beret, especially in that time period, you went to Ranger Battalion for 4 years, 3 or 4 years.
3 years, yeah.
Got some time. I think it was at the time for SF, it was like a minimum of 2 or 3 years. You had to be like an E4 promotable. Yep. And then... You went to selection then?
I did. I went to selection. I was actually in SFAS for 9/11.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that happened. And then came back and I figured, hey, we're going to go right to war or this whole thing isn't really going to happen. You know, because that's the way all the conflicts had gone. There was, you know, Panama, Grenada, Mogadishu. They were quick and then they were over. Mm-hmm. So I got back from SFAS, got selected, excited. And then we got told, hey, we're going to jump into Kandahar. And within 24 hours, that all evaporated and 375 ended up jumping into Kandahar.
Right.
So I immediately thought like, oh shit, man, I just missed my generation's war. Like, do I have to hang out for another decade? Or like, because there was a lot of guys at that point, like a lot of senior NCOs who, for whatever reason, they had just missed, you know,
everything.
Desert Storm or whatever. And it's like, damn, man, was that it? You know?
So
it's funny to say now, because like the wars are still going on.
We were panicked back then because 100%. Every opportunity to do anything, I think 375 jumped into Rhino.
Yeah.
They were like, that's the jump.
That was it, man.
Missed the boat.
Yeah, that was Panama.
It was only the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. How did it work out for you attending the Q course? Did you have an urge potentially to stay in battalion because of the fight?
I was pretty torn. Yeah, actually, I kind of think had 275 immediately come down, had they started the deployment train, I think a lot of people forget there was a little bit of a gap. There was the initial push into Afghanistan, and then the deployment cycles didn't start properly, probably really until like 03.
Yeah.
And so 375 went and did that jump, and it was sort of like, well, I guess we're just going to go back on a regular training cycle.
Yeah.
And so at that point, you know, fifth group had just done like the men on horseback and all that. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll go to SF and they'll have an enduring mission there. Cause that's kind of what SF did. Mm-hmm. You know, that was in my mind, like, okay, I'll get to go do something. It won't be that cool, but I'll go do something. Like these guys seem like they have a better chance than these guys. So ended up just, you know, calling them up and saying, hey, give me orders as soon as possible to the Q course.
Yeah. So, what was your MOS in SF?
I was Bravo.
Okay. Yeah. Same. And then, so you go to the Q course as a Bravo. Yeah, you're a little bit ahead of me in the Q course because I went to selection in 02 and started at the end of 02, the Q course.
Okay.
So you go through 18 Bravo stuff. You get out. What group do they assign you to?
I went to 5th.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So a good group for war.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, at the time, 5th. I mean, 10th was involved in like the initial push into Iraq a little bit, but really just 5th and 3rd.
Yeah.
That were well known for like, hey, if you go there, you will go to combat.
You're going to war.
Yeah. So like there's a lot of guys in my class who were like, oh, we want to go to 10th group or 1st group or whatever. I think I just wrote like 555 and they were like, you have to pick a different one. I was like, great, 5, 3. I was like, what? Okay. Yeah.
I think I was the same way. I did 3, 5. I think 3, 5. And I didn't want anything else because everybody else wasn't going because they had their own area of responsibility.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the war zone.
Yeah.
But I ended up going to 3rd. How many rotations did you get in 5th?
I did 8 tours there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you're there for a good while.
Yeah, I was there for 10 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
10 years of solid doing combat.
Yeah. All of it on the team. I lucked out, man. I did 18 Bravo for 3 years, and then I did Fox. And then when that time was up, I did Warrant. And then,
smart man.
And then by the time they were like, "Hey, you might need to be the company ops warrant or something like that," that's when I put in my packet and went to selection. So
that good for you, man. Like for people who are listening to this, the smart path is to always evolve. Like every couple of years, because if you don't, you'll come on orders from SWCC or some other recruitment retention, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But if you're constantly evolving and moving, your clock resets.
Exactly.
So it resets when you become a Fox. It resets when you become a warrant. Yep. And then you could be a warrant for a long time.
For a long time, yeah.
Before you start getting a lot of experience and then they want to pull you into some staff position, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So 10 years in. So then you decide to drop a packet. I'm not sure how much you could talk about it because there's a lot of sensitivity around the organization that you work for. But it was a special missions unit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how was that process in selection? And then how was that unit for you guys?
It was awesome. I mean, it's a very unique unit. Obviously, can't say a lot about it. The way we kind of caveat it in the book, and this, I guess, is DOD approved. It combines intelligence professionals and special operators to do pretty unique stuff for the country. So I didn't know a ton about the unit going into it. I had worked a little bit with some of them overseas doing some compartmentalized, more intelligence type of stuff. And so there was the mystique. It was close enough to kind of touch it, but I didn't know. I thought I was making a decision when I went and became a warrant that, okay, I'm going to stay in group. And that's kind of it, which I was fine with because there was a lot of work for fifth group to do. I love being on an ODA. I still think being on everything I've gotten to go do, whether it was, you know, special mission unit or being at the agency, like I still think being on an ODA was like the coolest thing ever.
Same.
Yeah.
Same.
Yeah, but once I found out that, hey, your team time might be up, then they're like, hey, there is the special missions unit that actually takes warrants. And I was like, okay, now you got my attention. I'm interested. And the selection's pretty much everything you'd expect from a selection with a lot of twists that are still, luckily, still pretty secret. So I don't want to ruin it for anybody. But it definitely keeps you guessing physically and mentally. So, and then the training pipeline is about a year long. So it's a year of being a student thinking like, is today the last day? is today the day they cut me, you know?
So, yeah. A lot of pressure in that.
Yeah.
I'm curious to why that particular unit has remained so classified. I understand the classification, but remained so hush hush from even operators who've been there. I know a couple guys, I've even interviewed a few that have been in that organization, but even the guys that I met being affiliated with other U.S. Army Special Operations Command organizations would not talk a lot about it. I'm like,
yeah,
I'm in this, I work in the same field. Can you talk a little bit? We're supposed to do stuff together. And it just wasn't something that a lot of people talked about. What it was, it the NDAs? Was it the culture? What do you think that was?
I think it's the culture. I mean, you sign all the same NDAs that you do anywhere else, but it was really deeply ingrained in the selection process. And then also in OTC and just being at the unit as well. Like, hey, we don't advertise what we do. And then also a lot of it, they compartmentalize heavily. There's people who I've ran into who like, we're in the unit at the same time. And like, we know some of the same people, but we never saw each other. And so like, unless you went to selection or OTC of somebody or did a deployment with them, but then a lot of times when we deploy, we're doing kind of our own thing or we're attached to a different task force. So I think a lot of that too, is just like there isn't one big training evolution you all go do like as you would in an ODA or one of the other SMUs where you're kind of all together as a team. That doesn't happen anywhere near as much.
Yeah. I just talked to your unit commander who's been in the unit, I guess, longer than any commander in the history of commands. And I recently talked to him and I sent him some books, my book prepared just for some of the new guys coming in. It's a really cool organization. Like you said, that mixes intelligence, especially because the Defense Department, at that time, we were constantly battling for operational relevancy.
That's right.
And so we didn't have a seat at the table. And then when the Department of Defense started evolving these practices and building rapport, especially interagency rapport, it allowed us to kind of have a voice and have validation.
Yeah.
There's some components to that where I saw them give certain areas of responsibility to your organization. And I was like, oh, so these guys are in it.
I mean,
they're giving them this entire real estate to do whatever they want and they're building it. And then I ripped in 2010, 11, something like that, when you guys handed it over. And I was like, oh, I was super impressed. A lot of the guys that I trained in, especially counterterrorism, 1208 congressionally mandated programs were assessed, recruited, and began by you guys. Except it wasn't like, me and half of my ODA from a commanders and extremist force. It was like one guy.
Yeah.
if they're lucky, two guys maybe.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really cool. Autonomous, allowing you guys to do unilateral things. It was really cool. So you had a good time in that organization.
I did, man. Yeah, it's choose your own adventure. I mean, if you're already in the soft community, ask around about it. It's kind of hard to figure out like what's the actual process.
Yeah.
They sort of kind of find you. You got to kind of find them. You got to meet them halfway.
Yeah.
But it's definitely worth doing. I mean, if you just kind of have an eclectic talent set and interest set, that's definitely the place for people that want to take it to the next level.
Some of the smartest dudes I've ever met, I don't know if I'm sure they recruit like mini units for aptitude.
Yeah.
But also experience.
Yes.
Some of the most experienced dudes I've ever met belong to that organization.
Yeah. So they take warrants up to CW3, but they also take E8s. So there's a lot of guys that will get done with their team sergeant time that still have an opportunity to go. So I had a guy in my class who actually pinned sergeant major while he was in the class. And like you said, at the beginning, he reset his clock.
Yeah.
So he got to totally reset and be a brand new guy all over again.
Yeah.
You know,
he ghost assaulter as a sergeant major.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, just living the life.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah. So good for experience level.
So you got a lot of experience in that organization, I imagine.
Yeah. I did a couple deployments there as well. And that I knew at some point I wanted to transition over and be a paramilitary ops officer in the agency.
Yeah.
The day I retired, I basically signed. I retired on a Friday and then sworn at the agency on a Monday.
Were you a full-time paramilitary operations officer?
I was. Yeah, I was. So I got to go to the farm when I was in the last unit we talked about. So I was already qualified case officer. I kind of got sick of, from my time on an ODA, of us getting fed intel and us not having our own ability to really shape the environment. I think that's what Green Berets did best.
Yeah.
And then as I was in the unit, I really saw that, hey, if you want to have a seat at the intelligence table, you need to go to the farm. You need to actually understand the way the intelligence community works. And so I wanted to go be a full-time, paramilitary ops officer, but then also transition later on into being a full, CIA ops officer to help bring some actual ground truth. That's a big part of a lot of the failures I think we had in the war on terror. was that you had Washington DC ideas, or you had the ideas of the brass, but you didn't have guys like us who were like living in the dirt every day, training with the John D's, talking with the Endige, who were actually making decisions and really wanted to bring that to the table at the agency.
Yeah. My favorite chiefs at bases were guys who were former GB guys, Crown Branch guys. And that was my path as well. I think I've got my bachelor's degree. It took me 15 years.
Me too.
Yeah. Nickel and diming that degree. I think I got mine in 2012, and same thing. I got out to go GB. When you go through that process, Ground Branch officers that are case officer qualified, especially, are developing intel that drives operations.
Exactly.
And then have the ability to nearly, in some cases, unilaterally evolve the op.
Yeah.
So we got the intel, let's do it ourselves.
Exactly.
You know, which is awesome. That's the kind of the luxuries that you get from a counterterrorism perspective on an ODA.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're operating in the agency or interagency, if you don't have those qualifications, if you can't write a cable,
right?
If you can't shape intel, they don't care anything about you.
Exactly.
So you were that guy. You had all the experience. Man, you have like the near perfect emulation of a career field. Of doing all, checking all the right boxes leading into that career field. Why did you how long did you do that for? And why did you decide to shift from that?
Yeah. I mean, really it was decided for me. So when Shannon got killed, my late wife, when she got killed in Syria,
wow,
that's when I was like, I was overseas as well. We have two sons. So I was like, this obviously it was a horrible day, but it could have been much worse. Like I was outside the wire, not in the same place, but I was outside the wire doing stuff that could have gotten me killed.
Same country?
Not in the same country. She was in Syria. I was in Africa. Wasn't doing anything super dangerous, but danger's always there. And I was like, man, I could have made my kids orphans today. So I'm going to figure out later on what I'm going to be when I grow up and just step away from all this.
Yeah. So you are Blue Badger.
I was.
So you're full-time GB.
Yeah.
Which is a huge deal, guys. I mean, in the world of paramilitary and counterterrorism, it's like the pinnacle of where you want to be. And I remember they did make a requirement where eventually you would have to get qualified.
Yeah.
And that attrited a lot of people because some guys just couldn't get through that course, which is a difficult course to say the least. So how many years were you on the job before this happened?
Just a year. Okay. So I just left the military. I did the initial like selection, a little pipeline you do for GB. And then I was out the door for deployment.
Man. So you're living the dream.
I was, yeah.
How difficult was it to have a relationship with sons?
Yeah.
And have a mom and dad who are committed to service?
Yeah.
How difficult was it to raise a family or just maintain a relationship in that situation?
It was hard. And I mean, had Shannon not been from the community herself, I don't think it would have worked. But the fact that we could be pretty candid with each other, you know, she had a clearance. And so it was like, I didn't have to talk around what I was going to do and where I was going to be and all that type of stuff. And then same thing for her as well. She definitely, and we talk about this a lot in the book, my portion of the book really is writing about our relationship, but she definitely gave way more than I did. She was the one that stayed home the vast majority of the times while I was off deploying. She was attempting to shift her career to be much more of, you know, stay at home role. Obviously that didn't work out. She ended up getting deployed with the task force and over to Syria and all that. But yeah, it was challenging. We both had really supportive families. So my folks would come out and help out a lot. So would her parents, her sister. So it was tough, but just because of who she was, she made it all kind of stick together.
Talk to me about notification, man, because I know notification is a wonky one. We know how military organizations and interagencies and notify people. I imagine that is very different when you're in a role and position overseas working for the agency.
Yeah.
Do you remember that day very vividly?
Yeah, very vividly. So I had been, out just doing a mission. I came back and the guy who was in charge of our little base, there was a guy I was actually on an ODA with. And he said, hey, he kind of had everybody leave the room to talk to me. And I was like, man, I wonder, did I screw something up?
Yeah.
You know, and he was just like, hey, I'm just going to tell you what we know right now, cause we don't know a lot. He was like, there's been a suicide attack in Manbij, and there's two females that are killed. But we don't have any names yet. He's like, do you know where Shannon is? And I knew, because we could communicate on secure systems, I knew exactly where she was. I knew she was in Manbij. I knew pretty much where she was going as well. So I said, yeah, she's there. So I attempted for the next about hour or so to get a hold of her talk just to see if they had any more information, because there's not a lot of women in this line of work. So I knew at that point the odds wasn't looking good. But I thought maybe there's a chance that the information was bad or whatever. So I spent about an hour or so trying to call around back to Syria to figure out what happened. But by the time we called their talk and all that, we had, you know, official notification. And so it was really just literally a guy who I was, you know, junior weapons sergeants with on the team, you know, 20 years later, almost telling me that, hey, your wife was killed. And we're going to,
he said that over the phone or
no, he was face to face. He got the confirmation from our guys in Syria, because it's a small, you know, small community. So our guys were working right there. They knew who Shannon was. And so they relayed it back to him, and he told me.
God. Where were the boys at when you got notification?
They were at home with my parents.
Okay. Yeah. I imagine from that moment for a while, things were just a blur looking back on, because you go through all these processes. How did the CIA treat you during all that?
They were great. I mean, the GB and just the CIA in general was really supportive. I mean, they gave me all the time we needed. Getting out of country, because I was kind of in the middle of nowhere, they were like, hey, we're gonna move heaven and earth to get you out of there. Right when the sun came up, they had an aircraft there. They flew me, my buddy, who was the chief of base there, he flew out with me, and then handed me off to another guy who we served with. We were all from there's a bunch of guys from my team ended up over in Ground Branch, but he met us in Europe and got us back to the States. So, I mean, they were incredibly supportive, like nothing but good things to say about the way they treated me and the family.
Yeah. I've always said that, you know, I'm not like a big fan of the FBI. I'm just not a fan given our track history. Right. But I will say that the agency in every way, I mean, yeah, sure. There's kids who think they're drag born, you know, but that's just part of it, you know, but I don't think I've had any bad interactions with those guys, because it all comes from a good place, and they've treated people really well, a lot better than military organizations that I work
for. They definitely treat their people much better than the military.
Yeah.
Also, they have that human capital angle figured out, that if they treat people well, people will do almost anything for them, which is true. So it's, nothing but good things to say about.
Yeah. It's ingrained in the culture. Let's talk about Shannon.
Yeah.
So, give us a little backstory on Shannon and her military history, and then at the point in which you guys meet.
Yeah. Yeah. So Shannon's native New Yorker. And so like a lot of New Yorkers, when 9/11 happened, she was like, hey, they attacked my city, I'm going to go do something about it. So she's about 3 years younger than me. So she had just started college, wasn't planning on going in the military. She knew she had a talent for languages. So she taught herself French and Spanish. She knew that was kind of her thing. So 9/11 happens. Her dad and her uncle are both Ground Zero first responders. Dad's a career state trooper in New York, and their uncle's a New York City firefighter. So they both went immediately. And this is, you know, before everybody had cell phones. So they both immediately went essentially dark for like 24 hours, because they were down there at Ground Zero helping out with that situation. And so then Shannon and her brother, you know, once they realized that, you know, the towers got hit, and their dad and their uncle were there, but they're fine. Her and her brother's about a year younger than her. They both went and did what a lot of Americans did, went and found a recruiter and said, hey, put me in. I want to serve.
Wow.
So Shannon knew she could learn Arabic. She was like, okay, these guys are from the Middle East, I can learn Arabic. And so she basically went to like the classic recruiter story. Like she went to the army recruiter and they were like, we think that you should learn Chinese. And she was like, do you guys just see what happened? Like, I don't want to learn Chinese, I want to learn Arabic. Like, and so she eventually, the only recruiter who gave her the time of day and said, yeah, we can teach you Arabic for sure, was the Navy. So she ends up enlisting in the Navy. Her little brother went into the Marines. He just actually retired from MARSOC as an EOD guy.
Wow.
But yeah, Shannon went there, went to DLI, learned Arabic, and then basically said, hey, I came in the military to deploy. Let me. So she got to Fort Gordon, where she was just supposed to sit with some headphones on and translate. And she was like, I really want to deploy. And her supervisor was like, you want to deploy? Okay, well, we need Arabic linguists to deploy. So she got put on an individual augmentation, like not knowing where she was going to end up. And she ends up at Siege Yasodif as an Arabic linguist. And this is probably about, '07.
Was it FET teams back in the day?
So no, there was no FET teams.
Was that before FET?
Yeah, this is like pre-FET. So she's up at CGSOTF doing SIGINT analysis, translating Arabic. And then one of the strike forces at the time, I think it was being ran by the SEALs, says, hey, we need an Arabic speaker down here to like help us out with TQ. And Shannon was the only person who volunteered. And whoever was in charge at the time didn't really care that she was a female. They're like, all right, well, if none of you other guys are going to volunteer to go, like, we'll take Shannon.
Yeah.
And so she ended up kind of switching from having, you know, headphones on and translating and doing SIGINT stuff to being on the ground, doing interrogations, but then eventually working a lot of the HUMINT angles. So doing translation initially for HUMINT source meetings, but then she went the next deployment between the two deployments, she went to a HUMINT course where she was qualified to start running sources. So she kind of had two skill sets between SIGINT and HUMINT. And this is right when the SEALs said, hey, we'll take women in our intelligence section. So she went to one of the first selection classes for the special reconnaissance teams, ended up on a cross-functional team. So she, by the time I met her on her first deployment briefly, we met for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
didn't see her again until we ended up in the same unit many years later. But she did three different Iraq trips, and then she went to Afghanistan and did the VSO thing before we ended up in OTC together.
Yeah, and those, just for you guys' background, a lot of translators, including, you know, whether you are on a female engagement team or you're just a translator, period, you're in it.
Yeah.
There's no like in the rear with the gear, and then after the target's taken down, we kind of bring you up.
Yeah.
You're with the headquarters element while an assault troop's in containment and assault troop's doing sniper reconnaissance or containment. And then there's an assault hitting it. You're right there, maybe on the outside of the wall.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, in call outs, as we started calling out, you were right there for it all. So I'm sure she saw close combat during that experience, which I imagine made her more recruitable and more likely to be picked up by the organization, right?
Yeah, definitely. And then I think just having the two skill sets, because she eventually ended up getting awarded the HUMINTer of the Year from the DIA while she was technically a SIGINTer. So, I mean, being one of the people that could go out kind of without an interpreter and talk, she really, like, she was a super language geek. I mean, so she knew the modern standard, like, traditional Arabic, but she loved Iraqi dialect. So she could speak Iraqi dialect almost like a local.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I mean, and it was all like her, like one of those musical brains, because I'd ask her, because, you know, we have to learn languages, and like, I was about as good at it as like most Green Berets, you know, hard. Like if I memorize it and I hear it 100 times and maybe like.
Hardest part of the Q course, language school.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
But I asked her, I'm like, what's your secret? And she's like, so you just listen to the word and you listen to a native speaker and then you just don't forget it. I was like, okay, yeah, thanks. That like, that doesn't help out your average like human.
Yeah, you know? a beautiful mind.
That was exactly how her brain works. So she was really good at the Iraqi dialect, and that just, at the time, there was no big push to put women in combat arms. There was no push to put women in SOF, but there were a handful who I think just because of the skill set they had, they just sort of ended up there.
Yeah.
And so she was one of the ones, I mean, it was, you know, whatever, 2014, much later on, where they're like signing the memo, like women can go to Ranger school or women can go to, like, women can now go to combat. And she was like, okay, we've been doing this for like a decade now, okay.
Isn't that funny? I the original post when that started coming out, you know, I would just say, hey, this is not new. And people were like, oh, you're supporting this. And they got upset at me. I'm like, guys, this has been going on forever.
Right.
I mean, I've had on target Arabic speaking women that were engaged in direct combat, like shooting and engaging bad guys for, like you said, a decade prior to that even happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, just opening the doors for them as an opportunity to do it.
Yeah.
It's like, why would you not allow or afford them those opportunities? Yeah. They're already in it.
And especially in the intel world too. I mean, it's like, I mean, if you only have guys, then you're probably only going to talk to guys, especially in a place like the Middle East.
Yeah.
There's literally half this other population that they're just frankly not going to talk to us at all. But if you put a woman in there, especially a woman with some language skills, then bam, you just doubled how much intel you can collect.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
So you meet her and you guys form a relationship while being members of the same organization.
Yeah.
What's the name of the organization now? What do you guys call it? What's a safe word? What's a book?
I don't even know, man. Like, I'll just say like the organization that works. Okay. That works. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm afraid to say the ones that I know, because I know they'll probably be.
People can look it up and make their own guesses. Yeah. I won't be the guy. Yeah.
Don't be that guy.
Yeah.
So you guys build a relationship. You wind up getting married while in the organization. You have two beautiful boys.
Yeah.
And then you decide your paths are going to be your paths. You decide to go Ground Branch. She's still in the organization at the time, a member of the organization.
Yeah, yeah.
So talk through me from your perspective of what you learned about that day, and specifically, if you can, and if you want, what happened to her and her team that day? Because a lot of people, when we talk about these things, and I'm sure you reflect some of it in the book, might not even understand what it means. Like she's working in some country, and then all of a sudden she's killed.
Yeah.
But what were the points surrounding that specific interaction?
Yeah, I mean, so the short version, her and a kind of a cross-functional team. So there was herself, Scotty Wirtz, who was a former frogman, former SEAL, who was working for the DIA. He was basically there to help out with security. But then there was a special forces team there from Fifth Group. So there's John Farmer, who was also killed, and then John Farmer's interpreter, who's a Syrian American. And there was a civil affairs element that was out there as well. So basically a suicide bomber target of opportunity, or potentially he knew because it was put near the government center that if they had suicide bombers in that area, they would probably get lucky. So they were killed by a suicide bomber. But this is right at a pretty frictional time because Trump gave the order for us to pull our troops out of Syria in the Christmas time of 2018. So going into Christmas of 2018, she had just deployed right after Thanksgiving. Trump gives the order because we took out the last village ISIS controlled. Trump said, hey, we took out away all the ground the caliphate controlled. Let's get the hell out of the Middle East. That's when Mattis resigned. All the bureaucratic slow roll kicks in. She thought she was going to be out of there Christmas Eve. They were supposed to fly to Erbil and be done with Syria, potentially move on to, either stay in Iraq or even potentially come home, is what they're talking about. So there was a lot of friction, and I could see this because I was looking at all the classified traffic. I could see the culture with leadership at the task force, at the agency. Like, there was a lot of people who were very mad. I'd say at the mid-levels to senior levels that we were getting told to withdraw from Syria. Mm. So my perspective is that there was a big push to justify there still being a mission there. And although ISIS had been taken out, they didn't control any more ground. ISIS still, they had cells. They had, that's going to be going on there in Syria forever. We're not going to solve that problem.
Yeah.
But I think there was a big push, and I think you're probably seeing a lot of this right now too, since there's more talks of us pulling guys out of there because of all the attacks. There is a big push from commanders down to say, hey, let's go out and let's find more intel. Let's go out and find a reason to be here. That was very much what I was picking up. One of me and Shannon's last conversations that we had over text, I literally was like, I hate this. I wish you guys would just leave. And she was like, yeah, I get it. And I was like, do not be the last person to die in a war that everybody else has already forgotten about, because the country's already moved on. People don't even know we have anyone there. The mission really can't be clearly defined. So that's, that's kind of where my head was at the day it happened. I was obviously a little shocked, but at the same time, I was like, of course, this was going to happen. I mean, if you're not decisive in these situations, decisive going in, decisive getting out, and you're just kind of there.
You're floating in between.
You're just like, yeah, are we here? Are we collecting intel? Are we going to do ops? And it's the same thing with the guys that are there right now. We just lost those three service members on the border of Syria, Iraq, and Jordan. It's like, wait, what are we even doing there?
Yeah.
What was their mission?
Were they in a public venue when this happened? When they were
talking? They were. Yeah, they were in a public venue. So they were at right next to this restaurant that was, I think, used pretty frequently for government meetings and stuff like that. So
yeah,
a pretty easy place if you're ISIS, just kind of hang out, have a suicide bomber or two, and you'll probably get lucky. And just did that day.
There are a lot of casualties, I imagine.
Yeah.
on both civilian sides.
Yeah.
Because it was public venue. Did they ever figure out who did it, and were they able to target them?
Yeah. So they got the cell. They got the guy who dropped him off. So they had ISR up pretty quick. Actually, the Delta Force commander's helicopter was in the air at the time, and so his bird was the initial CASAVAC. So they basically just heard there was an attack on the radio. They saw the smoke. They were close enough to see the smoke, so they landed the bird. And then from there, a bunch of other reinforcements came in. So they were able to pretty much pick up really fast on ISR the suspected vehicles. And so from there, did the intelligence cycle and at least took out the cell. Yeah. Did a series of airstrikes. And yeah.
So when this whole thing happens and you're ripped or you're taken back home, you return back home and you police up the boys and you're going through this whole process. What was the very specific decision point for you to decide you can't do this anymore, that you have to reprioritize your life?
Pretty instantaneous. I mean, I knew I couldn't deploy anymore. I thought about just staying and, you know, can I teach? Can I do, you know, cause there's all kinds of other stuff you can do. But I kind of know my, I know my own weaknesses. Like if I would have stayed even as a, you know, just a contractor to be an instructor or something like that, I would have gotten sucked back in.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why alcoholics don't go to bars,
yeah.
you know, like, yeah. so I knew I needed to remove myself, from that. But then also my family's, you know, out here on the West Coast. So I wanted to get my kids closer to my family, just so they had that strong foundation. So it was pretty instantaneous, man. It was like on the flight out of Africa. I was like, okay, life just changed and it wasn't planned for. But I can't be getting shot at for a living anymore, or, you know, be in a position where I have to spend so much time. Cause you know, even if you have the best relationship and the best family ever, you spend a lot of time away from your family in special operations. You just do. And so I was like, well, there's now we just took out half of that. So I need to be the one that's here all the time now.
Well, just a question. I'm curious because you've experienced what I've experienced, and I'm always curious of the guy's perspective on this. Why do you think we chase the rainbow so much when it comes to that life? I remember specifically my short story is at the time that I was, because I got recruited in Libya, running a program that you guys were running, and they handed it over, and I started running it. It was a 12-08 program. At the time, I think it was a 12-07. When I took over that program, GB was plucking my dudes away, and they were taking my guys, and I'm like, and they were recruited, trained by me and my team, and I was like, all right, so I will give you my guys. So like, we worked a backside deal because I was like, they're actually going to be used because SOCAF at the time, this was their first 12-08 program, and could not pull their heads out of their butts and get the job done. And so the guy that was there, his first name is Chris, he recruited me, and I did a couple of the requirements, the interviews, and then had it lined out to step across the hall. And so I got out as an E8, migrated into 19th group in the reserve component, and then the sequester happened, which they stopped hiring.
Yeah, yeah.
And so as an interim, they made me a GRS guy. So I was a direct GRS contractor. And then they wanted me to go staff. And I'm like, well, if I go staff, then I won't be able to go full-time as a PMO.
Yeah.
And so I stayed in a direct role, started deploying. And at the time, GB and all the places I was at was not able to do anything. And it was when Brennan, when he took over.
Yeah.
And literally when he took over, when I was in Yemen, they basically shut down nearly all programs. Because they didn't want, it was too volatile and they didn't want anything to happen like a Benghazi. So we couldn't do anything. So I'm like, why am I doing this? And eventually, several rotations later, I said, man, I'm done. If there's not an active war, I'm stepping away. War truly inspired us to always be involved because there's always a fight. What's the next fight? But as things dwindled down, what was your motivation in that world? Because you we're likely going to accept that as your life forever, which many people have.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I just, honestly, it was like joining the army. Like I never considered anything else.
Yeah.
You know, people were like, I'm going to go out and I'm going to, you know, go get an MBA. And I was always like, okay, cool. Good luck. Like, sounds terrifying. I'm going to stay here. There's this next deployment. And so part of it was like, I think the excitement, the adventure, but then the other part, it becomes who you are.
Yeah.
You know, and there is always that next thing to chase, you know, like, you know, oh, I can go to a special missions unit. I can go to, you know, here and there. And like, there's always that. But then, I mean, I really felt, especially having, kind of being able to bridge the gap between operations and intelligence. If the wars kind of died down, then there'd be more intel work to do. If the wars got hot again, well, I have those skills as well, was kind of my mentality going into it. Cause yeah, at the time, especially that transition between Obama and Trump, it did seem like the wars were going away. They got hot again, but Trump said the intention was to kind of wind them down. So I was like, okay, I can at least be in a position where when the next Iraq war is being discussed, I can have enough credibility, enough WASTA to be one of the guys that says like, hey, all this intel is bullshit. You know, like we've seen this before to actually be a real decision maker. So that's like, I like to tell myself that, but a lot of it too is, the excitement. You know, you always want the next thing.
The adventure.
And I don't know. I mean, because a lot of us are that way. And you see guys when they get out, they either find a way to channel it positively, or they find, you know, or they drinking, whatever, you know, and then guys can really fly off the handle. Because I think all of us, to some extent, have an addictive personality. Mm. And that can be used for good or evil, or if that purpose is taken away completely. Because getting out is weird, you know, especially so weird. Like if you didn't plan it, like I didn't plan mine. And I was just like, so what do you do now?
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, this is a lot to think about. And none of it really had that spark of like, yeah, I want to, you know, the spark of joining the army, the spark of going to selection, you know, it's because it's really hard to replicate that anywhere else in life.
Well, let's talk about that, because you wake up and you resign, I imagine, from the position. You got your boys and you wake up and you grab your coffee and you're like, so what do I do now?
Yeah, basically.
So what is it you decided that you're going to do with the rest of your life?
So I was doing a little bit of instructing as a contractor with ASOT Corps. So I still got to kind of play with the guys a little bit, you know, and it was kind of fun. Give back to the community a little bit. I did that for just a little bit. And then I got a job as a project manager for a tech company, which was great. Gave me a lot of freedom. I could work from home. Didn't have set working hours. But it was, you know, challenging, because it's like you just left a pretty high octane job, and now it's like your job is to stay at home and, you know, just be a regular dude. But then 2020 happened, and really just watching the country lose its mind between COVID, with the government coming in saying that, like, oh, actually we are going to decide which businesses can be open, which ones can't, when kids can go to school. But then we were living in Portland at the time, and that's when the riots kicked off. And to me, the riots, like, it almost felt familiar, because I was like, this is not people just protesting for like civil rights or some nonsense like that. I'm like, this feels like Baghdad in 03 to me, you know, especially the way that law and order basically just said, hey, we're going to sit this one out and we're going to let Antifa kind of take over. Mm. To me, I was like, this is, a lot of people don't realize this, but this is different, you know? And if we don't start stepping up and figuring out what's going on in our community, this isn't going to just go away. And really, since then, I don't think things in the country have gotten any better. They've, you know, probably gotten even worse.
Yeah, there's a lot of command coordination things that guys with our backgrounds, we perk up and like, oh, this is not just some random act of activism. It's it looks very deliberate intentional.
Yeah, I mean, I sat back for a while and was like, okay, maybe this will just be some protests. Maybe they'll go away. Maybe it's just some dumb college kids. But that wasn't it at all, you know. And then just the way that the media was seeding that narrative and seeing the effect that that was having on people who otherwise would be reasonable and say, like, yes, it's a bad thing to burn your city down. They were getting just indoctrinated, and they had already been in receive mode from COVID, you know, like everything the government says, you just must automatically trust. And so now you had this wall of media coverage saying, like, oh, this is really just about civil rights and it's mostly peaceful. But being on the ground, I was like, no, this feeling is something that most Americans aren't familiar with. The only reason I'm familiar with it is because of what I used to do professionally. I'm like, but this is what happens in third world countries when all law and order dissolves. And you see whoever is the strongest and will act the most decisively. You see those guys rise up. And that's, I don't like who's doing that right now.
Yeah. And you decided to go down a road to be involved in making a change as a member of Congress.
Yeah.
In your district in Washington State. And so you make the move, and you decide to run.
Yep.
What was that experience for you like? And then what were the challenges very specifically that you faced looking back on it post the overall experience?
Yeah. I decided to run basically because everybody was mad at our congresswoman. But nobody was doing anything about it. So I had no intentions of running whatsoever. After Shannon was killed, I worked a little bit with the Trump administration. I was offered a job in a second Trump admin, which is pretty unique, I think, for guys like President Trump to go and want the input from people who had actually been on the ground. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to end up going back to DC. I'm of the mind, if your country asks you to go do something, you do it. So they said, hey, would you work in a second admin? And I was like, I wasn't expected to get asked that, you know, but absolutely. If you want to hear from a guy like me, because typically it's, you know, senior officers and stuff that go into those types of positions. So accepted that. And then the election went the way that it did. And people in my community were mad at our congresswoman for a series of votes that she had taken, but she voted for Trump's impeachment, was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. And so I started going to these Republican meetings and everybody was mad, but nobody was doing anything. Mm. And so I was just like, okay, you guys have been here longer than me. Like, what's the plan? Like, who are we supporting? Like, and everyone's just like, well, we're going to write letters and be mad at her. And so I was kind of like, okay, well, if no one's going to do it, then whatever, man, I'll at least try. And yeah, that was basically how we kicked it off. You know, we did the whole, I literally had to Google, how do you run for Congress? Like, yeah, you file with the FEC. And then basically it was really just a grassroots movement, man. We just went, any group of people that would give me a couple minutes to talk and just to say, hey, here's who I am, here's what I stand for, we would go. And that took about a year and a half. So I started out really, really early, just doing town halls. And really for me, what worked was going out and engaging with people. Because a lot of times our politicians, and I think they still do this, like they run very buttoned down campaigns. Mm. And then when they're in office, they're very buttoned down. They have a set of talking points they go after. They go and they talk to the people with the money, and like the people are kind of an afterthought.
Yeah.
So I found that by me actually going out and saying, hey, I'm a guy that wants to represent you, I want to hear from you, and I want you to understand where I stand, people responded really well to that. It was almost like people were craving that.
Yeah.
And so by doing that, we were able to beat a 12-year incumbent who was, you know, she had about $14 million on her side. We beat her in the primary, just fell a little bit short in the general. So I'm running again, give it another shot. But
what was the numbers? Talk to me about the numbers. Cause I saw that grassroots campaign as an outsider and was shocked when you didn't win.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, Washington seemingly is craving change.
Yeah.
And they're going through the same issues with the same politicians, whether it's legacy or affiliation with a party. And I was like, oh, this is guaranteed.
Yeah.
Walk me through the numbers on that. And then what were the lessons learned?
Yeah. Less than a percentage point. So it was 2,600 votes.
Than a percent?
Yeah. Yeah. So they did a recount and all that stuff too. It took them 2 weeks to count the votes. So
yeah.
There's that whole angle. But yeah, it was really tight. I mean, the big thing, we had a hard fought primary, and our primaries are really late. Our primaries are in August, and we do mail out voting, unfortunately. So by the time the primary is resolved in mid-August, they mail the ballots out for the general about 5 weeks later. So if you have a brutal primary where your party like has a civil war, it's really hard to unite the party afterwards. Like a lot of the primaries that happened, you know, just a couple weeks ago at the beginning of March,
yeah,
those guys have time. They can beat the crap out of each other all winter, and then they can hug it out all spring, all summer, and yep, they can go into the fall as one team, one fight. For the states that have late primaries like Washington, Florida, there's a couple other ones. We don't really have that luxury. And the Democrats have mastered this. The Democrats, I disagree with probably all their policies, but their political execution is pretty flawless. Mm. In Washington, they will not primary each other. They will, behind closed doors, decide which person they're going to put forward. Mm. And then they will fundraise and boost that person up all summer, usually while the Republicans are having a knife fight in a phone booth and just bleeding out money against each other. And then come fall, they've got all their ducks in a row. So that's what my opponent did. And they did it very effectively. So I took down someone who was relatively popular. And so we had a very divided, fractured Republican Party come mid-August of 2022. And the Democrats, without spending a dollar, got their candidate on the ballot. And she hit me on election day with, like, she had $6 million in the bank that she spent against me. I was fresh out of money because we spent it all to get through the primary.
Yeah. And the Republican primary was so divisive, it was pulling away votes from you because they're divided, obviously.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you do get people that are just like, well, that guy made me so mad that like, I'm either not going to vote for that ticket, I'm not going to vote, or I'm actually going to vote for the other side because I'm mad. It's just human nature.
Yeah.
I think we're mostly over that now in Washington. I think we've kind of realized like we can lose what should be secure seats if we're divided. So I'm endorsed by like the county parties and the state party now. So we should, knock on wood, be a little bit safer in the primary so that we can spend all of our money and all of our resources against the Democrats, against what they're doing to the country.
When is that run now?
So that's this August will be the primary, and then November, same as the presidential.
That soon?
What, that soon.
Already?
Yeah. Every 2 years is Congress, man. Yeah.
Because it's an overlapping race. So who's the person you're going against now?
Marie Perez. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in the same district?
Same district, same seat. Yeah. She's the one I went against last time. So.
Okay. How many years ago was that? It was every 2 years.
It was 2022. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so fast.
It's really
I feel
fast.
Like that was yesterday.
Yeah. I mean, that's the downside of Congress is it's every 2 years.
Yeah.
And so like those guys are constantly fundraising and constantly campaigning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like somebody like you, especially with your track record, your history and all the things that you've been through could solidify that seat and just turn it into a permanent kind of position because of your reputation. Because like you said, a lot of these people are going, they get in those positions and they don't want to rock the boat.
Yes.
So nothing changes,
right,
which is likely the reason that there's going to be change from her perspective.
Yeah.
But then you go in and you could be one of the representatives that actually rock the boat,
yeah,
that want profound change. And I see more of that, which is a good sign, yeah, but also there's the same legacy crew who aren't doing
there is anything. That's the yeah problem. And the thing is, like, the status quo has like gotten us to this point. I mean, we're like $34.5 trillion in debt. Like our kids, like when they're born, they have what, $250,000 already stacked on their back of debt.
Yeah.
If the country lasts that long, I mean, because realistically, the big picture of what's happening with the dollar, I mean, that could fundamentally change America really for a generation.
Yeah.
And we're staring that down the barrel, but yet you still have people on both sides of the aisle, unfortunately, that will say, well, hey, we just need to approve this omnibus package, you know, that spends $2 trillion more over what we took in tax revenue.
Yeah.
Because that's the way we've always done it, you know? And we saw this a lot in the military. There's always those guys who are like, but this is the way we've always done it. It's like, well, guys, if it's not working, why are we continuing to do this?
You know?
Why are we continuing to say that we can just send billions and billions of dollars overseas when, like, we have crumbling infrastructure here, we're being spent into oblivion, we can't secure our own southern border? But yet you get people from both sides of the aisle that are just like, well, yeah, but we need to do these appropriations bills because I've got earmarks in there for my district. Like, it's just, hey man, we have to have people that are willing to go in there that are not career politicians and say, like, we're going to do some uncomfortable things, but it's to save the country, because this path that we're on right now, man, that ends in absolute disaster.
Yeah, let's increase taxes against billionaires and entrepreneurs in this country, and then we'll accumulate, I think they said $500 billion, and let's just give that to foreign wars. Let's give it to Ukraine.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Ukraine needs that money.
Yeah, it's like, what are we doing? Oh,
yeah.
Our country needs saving. This is like a last resort. I don't feel like this is something that we're like, you know, we're good. You know, this is something, it's a hiccup in the road.
Yeah.
This is something that's pretty catastrophic, right?
Yeah, this isn't politics as usual. I mean, usually they always say, like, this election is the most important one because of this issue or that issue. But right now, the difference between, I'd say, like, our side and what the establishment, especially the far left, the Biden administration, the direction that they want to take us is so fundamentally different than what the country actually is, that this is one of our last chances, I think, personally, to save the Republic. Because really, same, if you just look at the math, like, we financially cannot continue down this path. And then same thing with, like, literally the World War II scenario. I mean, we've got countries that are being added into NATO. The NATO commander's out there pumping his chest saying, like, we'll put boots on the ground. And, like, we're just going to bring in, like, yeah, all these guys are just like, yeah, we'll do this and that to Ukraine against Russia. And it's like, well, that is, you're writing checks that Americans will have to cash with their
blood. That's right.
Yeah. Like, and that's just happening. And you get Biden just the other night. It's like, oh, and by the way, we're going to put boots on the ground in Gaza. It's like, did anyone vote for that? I mean, like, number one, our border's not secure. Like, 118,000 Americans get killed by fentanyl. I mean, I remember not that long ago, we went to war for 20 plus years because 3,000 Americans got killed. You know, were some mistakes made? Yeah, of course. But, like, we get Americans that are getting killed right now as we speak,
yeah,
from the border. And all Biden can do is fly more illegals in and turn a blind eye to the fentanyl and tell us that we need to send billions of dollars to, you know, whatever war overseas. Like, this can't go on. Like, we've got to stop this and right the ship. And that's not going to be easy.
It's not going to be easy. So, yeah, I have hope that we can get the A-team restored and then we can get back to fixing problems. But I also understand that just as, you know, the last Trump term was, he spent all the time going against false and disinformation, yeah, and instead of focusing on the job.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be subversion and sabotage the entire campaign.
100%.
And if he doesn't have guys like you backing him,
yeah,
managing legislation while he's dealing with all the things that he's dealing with, we won't get anything accomplished.
Right.
And we'll sink a bigger hole.
Yeah. And it's going to be a knife fight too. I mean, if I get into office and Trump gets into office, like, they're not just going to toss us the keys and say, like, well, we'll get you next time. Like, if you look at the way that the deeply entrenched bureaucracy in DC works, like, that's what was really working against President Trump. I mean, like I said, Shannon should have been out of there. All the forces should have been out of Syria before 2019 even hit because the commander in chief gave that order. But because of the infiltration of the administrative state, we've got this unelected branch of government that says, like, well, we don't really care who's in power. Like, we're going to do what what we want. And if you mess with us, then we're going to jam you up with impeachments, with bureaucratic warfare. So I personally think if things go well in November, we are going to be in for a major fight once all of us get sworn in, because they're not the left. And I think the administrative state, they're not just going to say like, okay, well, you guys run the show now for 4 years.
Yeah,
they're
not going
to
happen.
They're going to say, we're going to indict you guys. We're going to undermine you. Like it's going to be rough.
Yeah. It seems like you have in this purpose, a redefined yet similar purpose that you served in, all tied to service, all tied to duty. How are you personally? Like, I've been through a lot. Guys from our community go through a lot.
Yeah.
But to be at the pinnacle of your career and lose your spouse to a suicide bomber, and to have your world flipped upside down and basically pick up the pieces from scratch, start from zero, how have you been personally?
It's been the hardest thing I've ever done. I mean, you know, like anything I did in combat or in the military, like is a walk in the park compared to this, having to tell the boys that their mom's not coming back and this is going to be our life now. But really just they give me purpose. I think if I didn't have kids, it'd be easy to go down like a much darker path. But, you know, I realized that they're really young when Shannon was killed. And so at some point they're going to read the book that we wrote to see how I honor her. But then also they're going to look back and say like, what were you doing? Because I think we're living in really turbulent times right now that if we get it right and we save the Republic, that we'll be writing a history of someday. And there'll be an accounting. Like what did you do when the country was imploding? Just like I think for our generation, I think there's a lot of people who didn't answer our nation's call post 9/11. I think there's a lot of regret. I think there's people that regret that.
A lot, yeah.
You probably talk to them. It's a lot like, hey, I could have gone.
Every day.
I didn't go. Like, and so I don't want to have that same regret. Like I can't go get shot at anymore. But I feel like the fight is right here now on the political front. So that's given me a purpose. It has been challenging though, because it's weird. There are definitely days where I wake up and I am like thinking in my head, like, well, the next time I deploy, like I'm just like random thoughts. Like, I'm like, wait, no, I'm actually never going to do that again. Like, that's not my life anymore.
Crazy, man.
So yeah, it's still weird. And I'm sure everybody goes through that to a certain extent, but it's like, wow, I went from a place where I was always around guys, you know, like me and like you, almost to like where I very rarely see guys, you know, from our old life, and you're out there and it's just like, okay, well, this actually is the real world right now. You know, these politicians, you get elected by these people, they make real big decisions. And if I can help bridge some of that gap, then I feel like that's how I can serve the country now.
Yeah. It's different. It's a different landscape, different terrain, man.
It is.
It's all human terrain.
It's all human terrain. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a beautiful thing that men like you, your new amazing wife, Heather, are able to pick up the sword and continue the fight in just a different way. I mean, I think through my own purpose, whether it's giving people messages from your experiences on a podcast to even thinking in the future, like maybe I want to get involved in politics because I feel like a burden of responsibility that somebody has to do it. And,
and
a lot of people do talk in virtue signal. Few people walk the walk.
Absolutely.
And you're certainly walking the walk. This book, tell everybody, when does this book come out? And then what was your objective in writing this book for your wife?
It comes out May 7th. It's available right now for pre-order. It's just called Send to Me. If you do Send Me or Shannon Kent and Amazon or whatever, it'll come up. You know, my objective, it's kind of funny. I wrote it with Marty Scovlin Jr. He used to run Coffee or Die out of Black Rifle. Right after Shannon was killed, there was a bunch of like articles out about how, you know, her and Jasmine, who was the Syrian American, were like killed and like it was some sort of an accident. Like they really weren't in combat. And I got a little frustrated by that initially. And like the CENTCOM PAO or whoever, you know, put out like, oh, they just got killed at a restaurant. It made it sound like they were going out to lunch. And so initially I was kind of, I don't remember the exact moment that I said, okay, I'll talk to reporters or, hey, I want to write a book. But I remember being really pissed off. And I was like, look, man, like there's nothing super secret, squirrel. You don't need to tell everything about what they were doing, but you can at least say they were killed doing combat operations. Cause if you looked at the resumes of who got killed on that day, I mean, Shannon was probably the youngest one And she was killed on her fifth combat deployment. You know, John Farmer, you know, CW2 SF guy who actually I knew a little bit at fifth group. I mean, that was like his 10th combat deployment. Scott Wirtz had been running and gunning since 01. It's like, you think these guys are just out to lunch?
Yeah.
You know? So yeah. I was a little bit pissed off about that. And so I, you know, did a little bit of media with the New York Times and the Washington Post. And then I realized we had a long enough story that we wanted to do something a little bit more long form. So that's where I got introduced through a mutual friend to Evan, and Evan sent Marty out. And he wrote a pretty long article about Shannon. You can find that still on Coffee or Die's website. But me and Marty were just talking one day, and I was like, okay, I think we could write an actual book out of this. And so what I wanted to do really was have something that my boys can wrap their arms around at some point, and just, you know, beyond the stories that I tell them or that their aunts tell them, grandparents or whatever, that they can grab the book and they can get to know their mom. Because the part that Marty wrote is basically like investigative journalism. He went back and he talked to people from Shannon's childhood, from all the deployments that I, when I didn't know her before I met her. And then I wrote the portions about our relationship. So wow. I want our boys to have that someday so they can kind of take that, ask new questions, or at least just say, hey, okay, this is who my mom was, because they didn't get to know her at that level. But then also really just to tell her story. And I think through telling her story, we can tell the story of a lot of people who haven't gotten a lot of credit in the war on terror. I mean, you talked about the interpreters. I think there's been a lot of like women who were on the front line, a lot of interpreters. Like Shannon would always say to me, like, you can walk into a room and say, hey, I'm a Green Beret. And everyone automatically is just like, oh, okay. Like, they're deferential. They understand who you are, what you do. She's like, for people like me, we have like 10 different titles that nobody even knows what they are. Like, oh, I speak Arabic, like I've done, but they were right there taking the same risks as we were. And so I think through telling her story, especially because we can be a little bit more forthcoming, because tragically she's not with us anymore, we can really tell how a lot of these intelligence professionals, a lot of the linguists, like how they contributed to the fight. So the couple, it's not an action book or a tell-all, but a couple of the action scenes we have, we kind of do delve into how we find and how we fix and how we hunt humans. Cause I don't think that's really been covered that much at all. Like what happens before the wall charge gets put on and the shooters go through and kill.
That's the actual
guy.
Hard part, the easy part and fun
exactly
part.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Blowing in doors.
Yeah.
What amazing and beautiful tribute, man.
Yeah.
How can people see what you're doing and get behind your campaign and support you?
Yeah. JoeKentForCongress.com is the website. People can donate. It's greatly appreciated. I still don't get all the big corporate money or any of that stuff. So run off small dollar donations, and there's links on there to all my social media. So we're pretty active on all the social media platforms.
And the primary for you is in August?
August. Yeah. First Tuesday in August.
And then obviously election in November.
Yeah, November.
So in August, we'll know who's running
exactly
against the Democratic opponent. And then November is the election.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Make sure you follow the links down below, guys. Support Joe for Congress and pick up that book. I picked up my copy. Wondered why I didn't show up at the door. It's because it's available for pre-sale now. We'll make sure we put all the links down below. And I appreciate you guys. Till next time. Thanks, guys.